We've been exploring the book of Acts, which was written by a man named Luke as a continuation of the Gospel of Luke. Acts began with Jesus telling his followers to spread the good news about his kingdom.
And they would start in Jerusalem, then go out into the neighboring regions, and from there to the ends of the earth.
Now, in Jerusalem, their message was received by many and opposed by many, especially by the leaders of the temple. They were scandalized by this new claim that the whole story of Israel had been fulfilled by Jesus' life, death, and resurrection.
One of these leaders was a man named Saul of Tarsus, who worked tirelessly to stop the movement. That is, until he met the risen Jesus himself. And this encounter transformed Saul from an enemy of Jesus into a herald of his kingdom.
And so for years, he traveled about the Roman Empire using his Roman name, Paul, starting Jesus communities all over.
And one of Paul's greatest desires was that all of these diverse communities would see themselves as one unified people, regardless of their differences, Jew or non-Jew, male or female, slave or free.
Jesus was creating one unified family of equals living together under his rule.
And this brings us to the final section of Acts. Back in Jerusalem, where the movement began, the Jewish followers of Jesus were suffering from a drought and food shortage.
And Paul was so passionate about the church's unity that he began a major fundraising project among the diverse churches he had started. They would pool their money together so he and a group of representatives could take it as a relief gift to Jerusalem.
But it's not safe for Paul in Jerusalem. The Jewish leaders there dislike him so much, they want him dead.
And Paul knew he was walking into a trap. His friends all begged him not to go, but no one could stop him.
And why would Paul risk his life to bring this gift? Couldn't he have sent someone else?
Well, for Paul, this was personal. Jerusalem was where he used to participate in the murder of Jesus' followers. And now he gets to serve them. It's also where Jesus himself was executed. And so for Paul, it would be an honor to suffer there alongside his king.
Paul goes to Jerusalem, and as expected, he's found by his enemies. A mob forms, and they try to kill him. But Roman soldiers save his life by taking him into custody.
The Jewish leaders are accusing Paul of starting a revolt against Rome, but they can't prove it.
And the Romans don't know what to do with him.
Yeah, they can see Paul's not a criminal, but his claim that a crucified Jewish man is the risen king of the world, it keeps getting him into trouble.
And so Paul gets transferred from one court to another, until he demands that his case be tried before the court of Caesar in Rome. And so they happily ship him off.
Now, throughout this section of Acts, Luke, the writer of the story, has portrayed Paul's trials and imprisonments so that they resemble his previous stories of Jesus' trials and imprisonment. Luke's making an important point. When the people of Jesus follow the way of Jesus, their stories will begin to look like his story, which is beautiful, but it also comes with a cost.
On the way to Rome, the boat carrying Paul is hit by a violent storm, and everyone freaks out.
Except for Paul. He's below deck hosting a meal, just like Jesus did the night before his trial. Paul blesses and then breaks the bread, promising that God is with them through this storm. And the next day, the ship hits and then breaks apart on the rocks, but everyone's washed safely ashore.
Which is amazing, but Paul's not out of trouble. He's taken to Rome and put under house arrest.
But it's not so bad. In his house, he can host groups of Jews and non-Jews, sharing with them the good news about Jesus, the risen king.
This is a bold move in Rome, the center of power where Caesar rules the world as king.
Yes, you have Jesus's alternative upside-down kingdom, now growing in the very heart of the world's most powerful empire, all through the suffering of a prisoner. And with this contrast between kingdoms, Luke ends his story.
That's a great image, but the story's supposed to be about this message spreading to the ends of the earth. So shouldn't it continue?
Of course. Luke has left the story open-ended on purpose, so that his readers would know that the story isn't over, and that they can participate in Jesus' kingdom that is still spreading to this day.
That video is from the Bible Project. Just a great summary of where we are in the book of Acts. Now, you might remember from the last time that we were in Acts, back before Easter, that Jesus had made Paul a promise. just as you were a witness for me here in Jerusalem, you are going to be a witness now in the very heart, in Rome, in the very heart of the Roman Empire. Now, you might remember that that came, that promise came on the heels of Paul being rescued for the third time by Roman soldiers in the span of about 2 days from crowds who were wanting to kill him. And so I can imagine that when Jesus made this promise to Paul, Paul might have been thinking, wow, that is such good news. I'm actually going to get to survive my time here in Jerusalem. And I get to take the gospel to the very heart of the Roman Empire. But one of the things that we have learned in the book of Acts that we've seen again and again, the ancient world, just like our modern world, though beautiful in many ways, is also fundamentally broken. And so this promise that Jesus had made to Paul is going to get challenged along the way. This morning, we are going to see the first of three significant challenges to the fulfillment of the promise that Jesus made to Paul that he was going to get to proclaim the gospel in the heart of the Roman Empire. And as we look at these events, we are going to learn about, we are going to see a trap, a danger that we potentially face or that we might fall into as we seek to be good witnesses, the kind of witnesses to this world that Jesus wants us to be. So I want to invite you to grab your Bibles and open them to Acts chapter 23. Acts chapter 23. And if you don't have a Bible or a Bible app on your phone, we'd just encourage you to grab one of those red Bibles in the row in front of you. If you're using one of our red Bibles, we're on page 1733 in the red Bible in Acts 23. Somebody lost a ring. Does this belong to somebody on the worship team? No. Might be in trouble if I stepped on it and broke it, so. Acts 23. So just hours after Jesus appeared to Paul and made him this promise that he was going to get to preach the gospel in Rome, a group of Jews get together and they conspire to ambush and to murder Paul. And in fact, they even convince some of their religious leaders to help them out in this plot. Look at verse 12 in Acts 23. The next morning, and so this is the morning right after the promise has been, Jesus has made this promise to Paul. The next morning, some Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. And they went to the chief priests and the elders, and they said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets there, gets here." So what we have here is the first of three serious threats to this promise that Jesus has made to Paul. Today we're going to look at the first one, this threat of violence. Now if these conspirators are successful, Paul is not going to survive his time here in Jerusalem. And he certainly can't take the gospel to Rome if he's dead. Now, we don't know for sure who these conspirators are. They might very well be from a group known as the Zealots, which they were a Jewish extremist group who were known for their willingness to use violence in order to reach their goals. They were very willing to kill those who were loyalty to Rome, who were loyal to Rome, including their own countrymen if necessary. Now, Paul's loyalties were certainly to Jesus, not to Rome. But if, in fact, these conspirators were zealots, they may have considered Paul's message of Gentile inclusion in the kingdom of God a sufficient reason or sufficient justification to assassinate him. Now, this is not just a small group of disgruntled nationalists. In fact, more than 40 people pledged to neither eat nor drink until Paul was dead. Now, if you are wondering what might happen to them if they turn out to be unsuccessful in their plot, you know, whether they might then starve to death, the way that this actually worked is that oaths like this, if the situation changed such that it wasn't going to be possible for them to be able to keep this oath, that oath was then considered null and void. But anyway, the problem for these would-be assassins is that Paul, at this point, is still being held in the Roman barracks. And the Roman barracks is, of course, full of Roman soldiers. And so he is out of their reach as long as he is being held there in those barracks. And so these assassins, they need to find a way that they can control to at least some extent, to get him out into the open so that they can then ambush and kill him. And so these assassins, they have a plan, but it requires assistance from some of the religious leaders who are part of the Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin being the Jewish ruling council there in Jerusalem. Now, you might remember from the last time that we were in Acts, which was back before Easter, that Paul had already appeared before the Sanhedrin once. John actually read about it in our scripture reading this morning. The commander of the Roman soldiers had brought Paul to the Sanhedrin, to a meeting of the Sanhedrin, because he was trying to figure out why it is that Paul's presence and his message there in Jerusalem, and specifically in the temple, was causing such a disturbance there in the city. You may also remember that this meeting did not go particularly well. The commander did not get any of the answers that he was looking for. The meeting itself nearly turned into a riot, and once again, Paul had to be rescued by soldiers so that he wasn't killed. But the assassin's plan is to have Paul brought to the Sanhedrin once again, and they're going to set an ambush for him while he is en route. They know, of course, that he's going to be accompanied by Roman soldiers, but unlike when he is there in the barracks, there are not going to be so many soldiers with Paul that this team of 40-plus Jewish men are not going to be won't be able to overpower them. But the only way that they can get this to work is if the Sanhedrin will formally request of the Roman commander that Paul be brought to them again. And so it's only with the help of some of the chief priests and the elders that they can accomplish this. But apparently they do in fact agree to help in this assassination, since it seems that they too believe that Paul, in this message that Paul preaches, is a real danger to them. Now there's always a downside to having a lot of people involved in a secret plot. Because the more people who know about the secret, the more likely it is that the secret's going to get out. And luckily for Paul, his nephew finds out what has been planned. And his nephew is able to get word to Paul. Look at verse 16. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and he told Paul. And then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, "Paul the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring you this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man by the hand and drew him aside and asked, "What is it that you want to tell me?" And he said, "Some Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." And the commander dismissed the young man with this warning, "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." Paul is a sister. Paul is a nephew. We don't know anything more about them other than that. Now, of course, people have speculated about this. Maybe Paul was estranged from his family because of the commitment that he had made to Jesus. Maybe his family had disowned him because he taught that both Jews and Gentiles were part of the kingdom of God under Jesus, who is the Messiah. Could be, but again, that is all just speculation. Whatever the state of Paul's relationship with his family may have been, when his nephew found out about this plot that had been made against him, he gets word to Paul. And when Paul learns of the plot, he sends his nephew to the Roman commander. And the Roman commander hears what's being planned, and he decides that he wants none of this. And so he works to get Paul out of Jerusalem, and he decides that he needs to do it quickly. Given the size of this conspiracy, that it's 40-plus men, as well as the scope, that even members of the Sanhedrin are involved, he's not going to take any chances. And so he sends Paul to Caesarea, a city on the coast, about 60 miles north of Jerusalem. Because this is where the Roman governor resides. His name is Felix, and Paul, who is still under arrest at this point, is put under his care. Look at verse 23. Then he, this is the Roman commander, called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide horses for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." And then he wrote a letter as follows. "Claudius Lysias," that's the name of the Roman commander, "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings." This man, talking about Paul now, this man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him. "But I came with my troops and I rescued him, for I had learned that he was a Roman citizen." Is that how it happened? Does that sound right? We'll get back to that. "I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusations had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him." So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and went as far as Antipatris. The next day, they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and they handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. So Claudius, the Roman commander in Jerusalem, he decides that he is going to take no chances with this conspiracy. He makes immediate arrangements to transport Paul to the governor. In fact, he decides that he's going to send them out right away under cover of darkness. And he's also going to send about 470 soldiers with Paul, which would have been almost half of the Jerusalem garrison. Of course, once they're well away from Jerusalem, they're safe from any ambush, many of those escorts return to Jerusalem. A Roman commander, he sent a letter to Governor Felix summarizing the situation at hand. But if you are a careful reader of Acts, if you've been paying attention as we've been studying this text, you'll see that Claudius, the Roman commander, he's adjusted the facts just a little bit to make him look a little better, like make his actions look a little bit better than they certainly were, than he certainly deserves. Because despite what he claims here in the letter, we know from Acts 21 and 22 that in fact Claudius had actually planned to torture Paul. And that in truth, he'd only rescued Paul because he needed to stop this riot that was breaking out near the temple. And it wasn't until after all of this had happened that he learned that Paul was in fact a Roman citizen. Of course, that's not exactly the way he explains it in the letter, is it? But more important than that is something else that Claudius says here. In the letter, he states that as far as he can see, as a representative of the Roman government, there is nothing dangerous or even treasonous about Paul's gospel message. This message and mission of Jesus is in fact not any real threat to the Roman Empire. You know, this is something that we have seen affirmed by other Roman officials as we've gone through our series in Acts. And it's actually something that we're going to see happen again as Paul continues his journey closer and closer to Rome. Now, that doesn't probably seem very significant, or at least directly significant to us today. But remember, it was to those who were the first readers of this account that Luke wrote, that is our book of Acts. Because those who were first readers of this account were still living under the Roman Empire. But anyway, upon arriving in Caesarea, Paul is placed under guard in what used to be Herod's palace, and Governor Felix tells Paul that he will, in fact, adjudicate his case, but he's not going to do so until those who want to bring accusations against him have had opportunity to make their case. And so for now, Paul has to wait there under guard in prison. And that is actually where we're going to leave Paul for today. But we shouldn't leave until we've given some thought to something that takes place here in this story. Something that I think illustrates a trap, a real temptation for us that actually has tremendous, that can do tremendous damage to the credibility of our witness of the gospel as followers of Jesus to the world. This trap, this temptation, this warning, ultimately a warning, comes to us out of this plot that was made against Paul here in our story. Now, I mean, just looking at it as a story, it's certainly a very interesting story. It's full of great drama. But if you think about it, it's also rather chilling. Not so much that these 40 men would conspire together to kill Paul, although that's not good, that is bad in and of itself. But I think what should really give us pause this morning is that some of their religious leaders, including high priests, were willing to go along with, were willing to conspire along with these assassins. They were willing to be party to Paul's murder. And keep in mind that who I'm talking about here, these are not just political leaders in Jerusalem, although they were that, but that these are also the religious leaders of Jerusalem. Among them were priests and elders. That means that these were people who were responsible for representing God in the communities that they were a part of. And make no mistake, what they are planning here is murder. Paul has not broken any actual law, either civil or even religious. And although he is under arrest at this point, he has not been found guilty by any sort of trial. And so this is murder, a clear violation of the sixth commandment that God has given to his people. But apparently these high priests and these elders, they consider it acceptable, because they so badly want to be rid of Paul. They just want Paul to be stopped. And apparently they have come to believe that any means are justified as long as it gets them to that particular end. And that is a dangerous way to think. And so this is the warning to us. Good ends do not justify bad means. Now, putting aside the fact that these religious leaders were just downright wrong and thinking that Paul is acting contrary to God's plan for the world, getting to a good outcome, getting to a right outcome does not justify the use of shady, questionable, or just outright evil means in order to get there. It just doesn't. Some of you may remember that back in the 1980s and 1990s, there were a whole series of bombings and murders that were committed against abortion clinics and against those who worked in these clinics. And those who were caught, who committed these crimes, tried to justify what they did as Christians because it stopped, or at least it was intended to stop, the abortion of unborn babies. Now, as Christians, we are, as evangelical Christians, we are strongly pro-life. We are strongly opposed to abortion. And not because we want to limit a woman's freedom to make choices about her own body, but because protecting the life and the well-being of a vulnerable person, in this case a baby, is more important. But that does not justify the extrajudicial killing of security guards or receptionists or nurses or even doctors who are working in these clinics. Because doing so would also be murder. And so, yes, we need to work to stop the murder of so many children through abortion, but getting to that end through the means of additional murder is not justifiable. Because for a follower of Jesus, the ends don't justify the means. Now, my guess would be is that most of you are probably already on board with that argument, especially in the particular scenario that I just described for you. Because, in fact, when those bombings and those murders took place, most Christian churches and most Christian organizations, while affirming the importance of protecting the lives of unborn babies, also denounced the violence that was being used to that end. And so maybe you're sitting there this morning thinking that this really isn't a temptation that you need to be terribly concerned with. But maybe there are other ways, while less extreme, that are still areas in which we use our intended ends to justify some very questionable means. As I think about this, one of the most, I think, grievous places that I see this play out, even among Christians, is actually in the media. I see some of our leaders who, on the one hand, they claim to be Christians, but on the other hand, are willing to very publicly say terrible and sometimes not even particularly true things about people that they disagree with, often politically disagree with. And then they and those who follow them justify this kind of behavior in them because what matters more than anything, according to their argument, according to their thinking, is that our nation turn back to God. You've probably heard this said before. And look, I completely agree that our community, that what our state, what our nation, what our world needs more than anything is Jesus. But our desire to see that end does not justify some of the means that we are seeing some of our Christian leaders use. And besides, it's not going to work. And it's not what Jesus did. And I don't think it's what Jesus wants his followers to do. And as I talk with just this last week, I had some communication with a student. She's not a student anymore, young adult now, but who was in the youth group that I was leading in Kodiak. And she and I were kind of just communicating back and forth about it. But the fact that we are seeing growing evidence that this kind of behavior amongst people who are professing to be evangelical Christians is actually turning more and more people away from the gospel, because they're so disgusted by the means that some very public Christians are using to try to get to a particular end. Now, truth be told, you and I have very little influence over what people say or do on TV. I mean, so let me try to bring this a little bit closer to home for us. And so let's talk about social media. But on TV, really the only choices we have is whether it's on or off and then what channel it's on and how loud we turn the volume up, I guess. But on social media, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever your favorite social media platform might be, we get to pick the words and the tone of our posts of what it is that we write, of what it is that we say, of what it is that we share with others. And sometimes I am really surprised by what some Christians feel like they are justified in saying on social media. Whatever the topic, politics, sexual orientation, sexual identity, immigration policy, role of women in the church, Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, whatever. I mean, the Bible actually has something to say about all of these topics. And the gospel has good news for all of these issues. And there is truth and there is grace and compassion and justice that just needs to be brought to bear in all of these areas and many, many more. And as often as not, you know, the biblical Christian position on these particular issues is different than that we see in the prevailing culture around us. But the importance of making the biblical position known, and it is very important that it be known, does not justify the means that some Christians are willing to use in order to make it known. Things like attacking or threatening or intimidating. That was Bible. It was Bible. The importance of making these biblical positions known, and it is really important, does not justify any means in which to make them known. So things like attacking or threatening or intimidating or disparaging or slandering or name-calling or insulting with those that we disagree with is not a justifiable means by whatever end it is that we are hoping to get to. Because when we start doing that, even if other people around us are doing it, even if the people that we disagree with are doing it, I mean, think about it for a moment. When they do it to you, does it get them closer to changing their mind about it? When they do it to you, does it get you closer to agreeing with them? Of course not. We're never going to change anybody's mind that way. And it just makes us, and more importantly, Jesus, look really, really bad. And so we can and we must do better than that. And I will be the last person to ever suggest to you that we should not engage in some of these issues, in some of these very difficult issues. Because I think that more than ever, we need passionate, thoughtful, committed followers of Jesus to really engage with the ideas and the messages that are so prevalent in our culture today. But how we say it is just as important as what we say. And how we reach our goals is just as important as the goals themselves. Because we are followers of Jesus. We are people who are made in the image of God. We are people who are filled with His Holy Spirit. And so that means that we are representing God. We are representing Him, both in what we do and in how we do it. We are followers of Jesus. And so for us, we should never give in to the temptation to rationalize that the ends can ever justify questionable means. Because I think Jesus cares about the ends, but He also cares about the means. And the world is listening not just to the goals that we have, not just to the ends that we are pursuing, but it also very much notices the means by which we are trying to get there. And all of that is part of our witness to them. We have what the world needs more than anything else, and that is the gospel. The good news that Jesus is the true rescuer king that God promised and that the whole world has been waiting for. But we also know that this world that God made, while beautiful in so many, many ways, is also fundamentally broken. And that means that sometimes life in this world is difficult. And it can be really messy. And it can be really complicated. And it also means that we're going to run into people who are going to oppose our message, who are going to oppose the gospel, who are going to oppose what the Bible teaches. Sometimes they'll do it loudly. Sometimes they might even try to do it violently. And so that too can get really messy and complicated. But we need to speak up. We still need to speak up. Because part of what the world needs to know is that there is another way. There is another way to live in this world. There is another better way to live in this world. To live according to the model that Jesus has set for us, that reflects the way that God has actually designed us to live. But how we do that, how we communicate that, matters just as much as the fact that we are communicating that. Because part of our witness is not just the message itself. Part of our witness, part of the way in which we are representing Jesus to the world, is how we communicate that message to them. Jesus spoke truth, sometimes very difficult truth. But he also did it with love and grace and compassion. And that too is part of what we're supposed to follow as we follow Jesus together. Let me pray as the worship team comes up.